This is episode 84 of Beyond the Bulletin. Hello and welcome to episode 84 of Beyond the Bulletin. From the University of Waterloo, I'm Brandon Sweet, editor of the Daily Bulletin.
And for Media Relations, I'm Pamela Smythe.
On this podcast, we go beyond the pages and pixels of the Daily Bulletin to inform you about important news and views from our community.
On the interview, I speak with Professor Shanna McDonald about communicating in a crisis.
Thank you for joining us as we go beyond the bulletin.
So, have you been enjoying the nice weather?
Yes, I have.
Very good. My little daffodils are forcing their way out of the ground.
We've got some flowers that, it's funny you were saying, forcing their way out of the ground. They literally forced a rectangular section of wood chips or whatever it is, mulch, off themselves as they were pushing up. It was literally like they were like a zombie coming out of a coffin. They were pushing it. And it was because it was intact. This piece of dirt just was just being lifted off in unison by all these, you know, these plants. It was great.
Like the manhole cover in Thriller.
Exactly, exactly.
Person hole?
Moving right along, here's what's been happening. First, some good news on the pandemic front. On Tuesday, April 13th, Region of Waterloo Public Health declared the COVID-19 outbreak in all University of Waterloo residence buildings is over. President Ferdinand Hamdallah sent a memo to the campus community this week thanking all of us for doing our part in following public health guidelines and increased safety measures put in place in response to this outbreak, in particular, those students living on campus. He said, and I quote, "While the outbreak is officially over, it remains critical that we all continue to follow the advice of public health officials. Please continue to do your part and follow the province's recent stay-at-home orders, which include remaining at home unless leaving for necessities such as groceries or healthcare services," end quote.
Effective Tuesday, April 13th, there are a number of adjusted safety protocols for residence buildings in place, including residents should continue self-monitoring for COVID-19 symptoms, and symptomatic testing is available at the Testing Assessment Center at Health Services. You still need a watt card or key to get into designated entrances. Security personnel are no longer at those entrances. The existing no guest policy remains. Students must continue to socialize with those within their household, that is, within their suite or traditional style residence floor. The only individuals in a room or suite should be the residents who live there. And as we are all in a stay-at-home order, all common use space, such as lounges and study rooms, will continue to remain closed until the end of term.
The president encourages anyone showing symptoms of COVID-19 to seek testing. It's available on campus for university students, employees, postdocs, and family members living in the same household.
To book a test, please use the online registration form. We'll put a link to that and other COVID-19 safety resources in the show notes.
We touched on this a bit last week, but employees who served between 5 and 50 years at the University of Waterloo were honored across a series of virtual events on Wednesday, April 6th. These events recognize the dedicated contributions and tireless efforts which have shaped the success of our university.
Including your tireless efforts, Brandon.
Well, their efforts anyways. That's right. So I was, in fact, one of the 501 employees. Maybe I was that one. I don't know. So this cohort of people who are celebrating this year, cohorts actually, would have started on campus in 1971, 1976, 81, 86, 91, 96, 2001, which is where I started, 2006, 2011, 2016, and so who reached major landmarks in their time at the university this year. Our Associate Provost Human Resources, Marilyn Thompson, hosted these virtual receptions, which were grouped for the 5 and 10, the 15 and 20, and then the 25 to 50-year employees over the course of the day.
Wait, did you say 50 years? Who's celebrating 50 years?
Well, this year, our 50th anniversary celebrant is Professor James Ian Monroe of Computer Science.
Hmm.
So at these virtual events, President Hamdallah also provided congratulatory remarks, and these events included a kudo board with messages of support from colleagues, and actually we all had the opportunity to connect with other members of our start date cohort in a virtual networking session on the Hopin platform. I thought that was a very cool concept because our campus is at once so diverse and decentralized, even in the best of times, and there aren't always opportunities to meet colleagues from different departments and units and kind of exchange, you know, introductions and that sort of thing. So it was a really neat experience. The whole event actually was very touching and a really nice gesture of support from the university administration.
That's great. Well, congratulations again, Brandon, and to everybody, all the honorees. We can all view the list of milestone recipients, check out the event videos, and send a message of congratulations directly to anyone you may know. We'll put that link in the episode notes on SoundCloud, which hosts this podcast.
In other news, you may recall that there were so many decisions made at the university's Board of Governors on Tuesday, April 6th, that we had to spread our reporting of them out. So, the board has approved a revised Policy 14, pregnancy and parental leaves, including adoption, and the return to work. That was its name, so it's a bit of a mouthful. Eligible employees who begin one of these leaves on or after April 6th have access to the provisions included within this revised policy.
So, a bit of background on this. The university's Policy 14 was originally established in April 1986 and most recently updated in 2006. A policy development committee chaired by Professor Moira Glarum of the Biology Department consulted with university community members, and the draft policy underwent a thorough review process at both staff and faculty relations committees. President Hamdallahpour brought the revised policy to Senate in March and then to the Board of Governors on April 6th for approval.
So there are several updates to the policy, but two key changes pertain to the level and duration of benefits during these leaves of absence. Pregnancy leave, which originally featured salary continuance for 6 weeks, now includes an EI top-up to 100% of salary for 8 weeks, plus an EI top-up to 95% of salary for 7 weeks. Parental leave, which originally featured an EI top-up of 95% of salary for 17 weeks shared between both parents, if both parents work at the University of Waterloo, that is, will now be an EI top-up to 95% of salary for up to 20 weeks, provided individually if both parents work at the university.
Because before, a couple who both work here had to share the benefits, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a good change. And the revised policy includes updates that reflect 2017 changes to federal and provincial benefits and leaves. It expands the eligibility criteria so that more employees have support and recognizes that employees returning from leave will need to balance pressures associated with parental and professional responsibilities.
If you wish to review the new policy, it's available on the Secretariat's website, and supplemental information can be found on the Human Resources website. We'll put those links in our show notes. Now, here's what's coming up.
While we're on the subject of benefits, many changes to the University of Waterloo Benefits Plan that were approved at the Board of Governors meetings in February and April will come into effect on May 1st. To help us prepare for the changes, Canada Life, the benefit plan provider, will be hosting public information sessions in April and May. These sessions will cover changes to the benefit plan, the next steps to take, and address your questions.
If you attend a session, you can expect to hear about benefits changes for in vitro fertilization, continuous glucose monitors, vision care, age for dependent children, enhanced paramedical and out-of-country coverage, and prescription drug management programs.
You sound like one of those DIY insurance commercials.
Oh, nice.
You cannot be turned down for any reason.
No medical exam required.
Following the presentation, representatives from Canada Life and Human Resources will be available to answer questions. These sessions are scheduled for Tuesday, April 20th, Wednesday, April 21st, Monday, May 17th, and Thursday, May 20th. We'll put the registration links in our episode show notes.
And now the interview. If you feel as though advice and guidance regarding COVID-19 is confusing, you are not alone. And while social media is a useful tool for sharing information to masses of people, it can also lead to the proliferation of wrong information and contribute to our uncertainty. Shannon McDonald is a professor of communication arts who knows how to clear the air in a crisis.
Shannon, it's so nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me again.
I hesitate to say, or at least I've wondered if I should say, that I found so much about the pandemic confusing, from what kind of mask is not helpful or even harmful, to who's eligible for the vaccine, to other rules around social distancing and essential trips and things like that. Please tell me I'm not alone here.
This is a common frustration we're seeing across the board.
Why is this happening?
I think one of the reasons is that we don't have strong communication expertise in the provincial government, specifically in Ontario. So we don't have people who are creating a clear, structured communication strategy. So that's one really big problem I think that's happening. And there's an assumption, I believe, on the government's part that by, you know, using Twitter and using these press briefings, that's enough. But it's not enough. And one of the reasons I would say that is because we're getting information fatigue. We also don't have time to watch press briefings. And so I feel like that's not the best mode of communication right now.
Is it possible that it's confusing just because the situation is changing rapidly?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I would say, to be generous, we could say at the beginning of the pandemic, it was worthwhile to give leaders the benefit of the doubt because things were rapidly changing and there was a lot of unknowns. But we are a year into the pandemic. And I would say that there's been a lot of opportunities for learning. We also have science advisory boards. We have a lot of experts who are putting out very clear information. And then what we're noticing is that that information isn't being taken up by our leadership, or in particular our government. And so you're seeing these dissonances and these kind of gaps between what we're hearing from one side and what we're hearing from another. And so that, again, is going to create fatigue and we're going to tune out. So these are really big problems, I would say.
It is exhausting. And being such an important topic and, you know, an emotional topic, it takes a toll. I mean, it just kind of creates this mental exhaustion, I think. At least that's how I feel.
Oh, I think you're 100% right. And one of the things that is making me quite disappointed in all of this is that as a society, and again, the leaders in our society are not taking the time to speak through what it means to be dealing with grief, loss, the trauma of these rapid changes in our lives. We're not talking enough about that and giving ourselves the time and space to explore that as a society. And I find that also very troubling. One thing that we see is we're seeing percentages, you know, mental health struggles are exploding exponentially, and there's all these percentages. I don't think that's going far enough. I think that we need to actually unpack and describe and name and think through the actual pain that we're experiencing on the ground as a society. And, you know, it's only through having those very sustained public conversations that people might feel that they're actually finally being seen and heard.
So what's at risk, or what are the consequences when we're in a crisis like a global pandemic and we have these communication issues?
There's a lot. I think the first one we can think about is actual the risk to public health. So if we don't have clarity on what changes when we have a lockdown versus a shutdown, and we really don't know what those things mean, and we are in the middle of having a lot of exhaustion ourselves, we're going to start tuning out. We're going to stop putting our trust in our public officials. We're going to start making our own rules. We're going to start creating loopholes for ourselves. And all of that is actually going to then contribute to the prolonging of these lockdowns because we will be not doing what we need to do, which is, unfortunately, stay home again.
And more spread in the community as well.
Absolutely.
What is the best way for officials to share information in a clear and unambiguous way?
I think having a really clear, structured communication vehicle. So I'm going to explain that for a second. If you had reliable visual graphics, say infographics with really clear bullet points that could be circulated widely across all social media channels. You could show it on the screens when you're referring to stories in the news. You could put it in papers when you're presenting news on the issue. A very clear set of infographics would be a great way to disseminate information that is unambiguous. But you must start by deciding what that information is, and it cannot change from day to day or week to week. And I know that that sounds a bit unforgiving because things do change. But if you had a clear system from the start that maybe said, okay, this is what reentry is going to look like after we, and these are the goalposts we need to meet. Like just that kind of clarity, I think would be really helpful. And then translating that into some really helpful direct infographics is an excellent way to spread information widely and quickly.
So on that, I did see an infographic. The source was the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the United States. So what's safe to do now according to your vaccination status? So the activity, something like socialize indoors, unmask with fully vaccinated people. On the one hand, in the column that says fully vaccinated, yes, you can do that. If you're not vaccinated or partially vaccinated, you can do that as well. If everybody is fully vaccinated or in your household. socializing indoors unmasked with unvaccinated people from another household. Fully vaccinated, yes. Unvaccinated, no. Do you find that confusing?
I mean, I actually found that to be a really helpful infographic. I know the one you're talking about, because it did utilize things like columns with yes and no, and it did describe things. I think one of the things that we're struggling with, and this is why I think communication experts and really, really strong graphic designers are key, to sort of take that fairly complicated scenario or sets of scenarios and distill it into these very direct, you know, things. So perhaps, you know, an example of that would be maybe if you were to show the infographic and have less words, which is kind of what we want, maybe if you were fully vaccinated, anybody that's body, say we just use those little like washroom people and you did those, you know, the bodies of the washroom people. Do you know what I'm saying? Like the washroom sign. If you set the group that is vaccinated with one specific color and then the group that isn't vaccinated with a different color, so say like blue and red, then that would even help further in doing that. I think it needs to be a coordinated. So I think we need coordinated dissemination of information so that we aren't hearing one thing from public health and another thing from someone else, that everything aligns, the rules align across the board. So there needs to be actual conversations happening amongst people who are producing the information. And I don't think that's happening right now. One thing that I found really, really helpful at the beginning of the pandemic that I would like to see come back is every night on the nightly news, it was both the national and I believe CTV had experts in to answer our everyday questions. There was everyday questions coming in from the public and they were being directly answered live on television. I found that very reassuring and very helpful. That might be something that we want to see return because again, the people who are being highlighted on the news right now are people who are on the science advisory boards. They are the experts. They are part of the vaccine rollouts. They know what's going on the ground. And so I do appreciate that as a source of knowledge. I'd like to hear mostly from the people who are dealing in the ICUs and who are epidemiologists who understand the models in ways that, you know, us as everyday citizens don't.
It seems to me that we're more connected, even with social distancing, than ever before. What with the multi-channel universe we have access to, the internet, social media. And so we're exposed to different views. But you might think that that means we're getting a broader perspective. But I don't remember there being so much confusion in a situation of crisis. Are we better informed?
No, I don't think so. I think this is a really difficult question in some ways because what we need to ask ourselves is what's the difference between the kinds of information we're getting now and where it's coming from versus what it looked like, say, 30 years ago. So 30 years ago, when you were relying on traditional media sources pre-Web 2.0, pre-social media, there was gatekeeping. There was gatekeeping as to how information flowed from experts into the public, and that was through news sources who were set to journalistic standards that they must verify the facts of information. Correct? And there was an ethics that came with that. Now, in what we call Web 2.0, or the rise of social media platforms, people who consume media and information are also now producers of media information. So the way that we understand this is that instead of being consumers, you are producer consumers or prosumers is what we call them. This means that anybody can produce information and share it at any time, and any piece of that information can go viral without any gatekeeping or fact-checking. That's not ideal because we're now in our state of real tiredness, being flooded with information that we can't always necessarily parse to see where the sources are coming from. One of the most pernicious parts of this is the fact that people are taking advantage of this and producing actual disinformation by using the kind of rhetorical tropes or the sort of symbols of factuality and expertise. So one thing that I always appreciate that Dr. Kelly Grindrod has said to me is if it's a doctor in a lab coat on a video that's through YouTube, it's not real. Now, I wouldn't have known that because I'm not a medical expert, but there's these little ways in which people who are actively spreading disinformation are using these images of expertise so that we don't second guess things. And this is why we're in a bit of a crisis of digital literacy that needs to be addressed.
Kelly Grindrod, of course, professor of pharmacy, who has been a guest on this podcast, specifically talking about correcting misinformation out there about the vaccine and the vaccination process. You are an expert who studies social media and specifically disinformation and misinformation on social media. What's the difference?
So, I mean, generally we understand misinformation to be false or out of context information that's presented as fact, but there's not an intent to deceive. It's not malicious. It's just sort of like perhaps the person is speaking without the best available facts. And so then those facts get taken out of context and misunderstood. Disinformation is a type of that that really plans to and intends to deceive or mislead the consumer of the information. And so that's where we see a lot of the problems within social media, where there is an intent to actually take us away from the facts. And that happens in particular through the use of appealing to our emotions. Mm. So whether that be fear, anxiety, outrage or anger, those things get kind of pulled. It becomes clickbait, and that's a really easy way to implement disinformation. And studies have shown, and this is, I think, one of the more troubling things, studies have shown that disinformation will spread, even misinformation, but mostly disinformation will spread 6 to 7 times faster than factual information. So it's an uphill battle that we're working with against the ways in which the social media platforms themselves actually support it.
Oh,
through the design. It's really troubling.
That is. What are we supposed to do about that as a consumer?
Well, I mean, first of all, it shouldn't be put on our shoulders. This is something that needs to be taken up by government regulation, policy, and tech companies themselves, ensuring that it doesn't happen. So we can't fight this ourselves. This is not for us to take up. But having said that, it's also really useful to be having large public dialogues about how to be digitally literate. And so, you know, widespread campaigns where we can teach people how to suss out sources that are being shared with them on the internet, where to trust, where to be more skeptical, how to follow up and find facts. This is really, really important to be pushing a digital literacy dialogue in public. I think it's a huge part, especially in COVID, of our public health strategies.
I have had many discussions with Waterloo experts about COVID, specifically about aspects of the pandemic, through the podcast. And I'm very fortunate to be in that position. So I've tried to correct wrong information using the information that I've learned from our very own experts with people I know on social media, and they don't want to know. They get very defensive. What's going on?
So I think this is a larger conversation about the actual effects of social media over the last decade. Because social media operates in a way that it wants you to stay and click as many times as possible and stay on a platform and give your attention on those platforms, because that's how people, that's how the big tech companies make money. Because of that, we have oriented ourselves as social beings consuming information in ways that completely conform to our existing worldview. Our social media platforms cater to us being reinforced in our belief systems. And so when those get challenged, it becomes a bit destabilizing because we have a new social way of being in the world because of social media. I'm going a bit, you know, deep here, but it really is quite troubling. And I think that we need to recognize and talk about that, and also recognize the ways in which social media and our consumption of it has produced quite a bit of divisiveness quite a bit of unwillingness to actually speak across divide or differences in perspective. The one thing that people aren't realizing is that their social media platforms, which is largely constructing their reality because it's the thing that they consume all of their information on, produces echo chambers. It self-confirms what they want to hear. And so we have become less able to actually encounter differences of opinion. And because social media is a charged space that's tied to our emotions, we're having a really hard time disentangling ourselves right now.
Every day there's a post that devolves into a fight about vaccines, and there's fighting and people are nasty to each other on there. I mean, what is the best way to deal with that when you encounter that in your scrolling?
Walk away. To flip the question, what is the value of trying to deal with that?
Right.
That's, again, not our responsibility, especially when it comes to certain issues. and certain charged spaces on the internet, which any group becomes.
Yeah.
I have seen it time and time and time again in my life. Any group that I've belonged to will fall apart based on some social issue where everybody is at odds. And it's heartbreaking. It's really hard to watch, especially the kinds of abuse and vitriol that get largely put onto marginalized participants in the group. I think it's really important for our own self-preservation and well-being to realize that there's some battles, especially on the internet, we cannot win, no matter how reasoned we are, no matter how reasonable we are, no matter how many facts we're armed with, and to walk away and not do that fight. It's not, it's just making the internet a worse place, and it makes you have a less pleasant experience. And so that's where we need to rely on strong leadership and clear communication from our leaders to help people to work through those things, probably in as much of an in-person or personable kind of way as possible. The more we can have low stakes conversations in intimate settings with people, the easier it'll be to convey facts and to deal with any fears that there might be. The internet is not the place for that. It hasn't shown itself to be that place.
What is the role of social media during the pandemic?
Well, I mean, you know, if we think about the best parts of the internet can be a place of connection and support. It can be a place where we feel less isolated, where we feel validated, where we feel like our experiences are seen by others. It's also a place where we can share humor. So, you know, the role of the pandemic, the things I appreciate the most about the pandemic are being able to reach out to people in my social support circles and be like, today's a hard day. And then, you know, giving me heart emojis or pictures of kittens. The rise of meme culture is really important because it's a way of kind of letting that cultural stress valve release. We do these, you know, memes are funny. They're relatable and funny. And so they can be a way in which we recognize the absurdity of our times. And it's kind of all put into one little visual package for us where there's often a joke. And that's a great thing to share that kind of humor and make people feel connected based on that. So I always think about the Bernie Sanders memes from when he was sitting at the inauguration.
Oh, yeah. Again,
those memes got shared in any cultural space that I existed in on the internet. And they're all different spaces. And everybody was remaking and remixing that meme. And I heard some people speaking about it over Twitter saying, this is what we could call joy scrolling. So often we talk about doom scrolling, where we're just glued to our phones in a pit of despair. And what the Bernie Sanders meme allowed for us, and there's many more, it's not the only one, allowed us for some joy scrolling or joy freshing, I think it was called, or something like that. On top of that, it can be a place ideally where, you know, valid news sources can be shared and we can get our information.
Okay, good. What other points did you want to make, Shanna, about this topic?
Realize that the world is bigger than the way that social media portrays it. The world is different than the way social media portrays it. Recognize that you are in a particular algorithm that is catered to you in uncomfortably accurate ways. Be aware of how that's all working. You know, brush up and learn about how digital technology operates. And then you can be an informed consumer.
And keep officials accountable?
Always. One of the things that I've been very happy to see in the past couple of weeks is journalists have been pushing hard against their use of language. And I've been very pleased to see that because I think it's really important that we're seeing opinion pieces coming from respected journalists who are just saying, this isn't okay. We don't have patience for lies anymore because things are very real and people are suffering and it's widespread suffering. I do think you're going to see grassroots changes and pushback all across the board going forward. And I think that's how we keep them accountable.
Oh, wow.
I was very pleased last week to be a part of the Global Engagement Summit, which is the culmination of a course that I got to co-teach with Dr. Shannon Majewitz this year. And it's a topics-based course. So this year, the topic was pandemics. And we had six fellows funded by the Jarolowsky Foundation. And these were six experts in different areas who all came in to speak with us on the pandemic. There was a question that came in about giving leaders the benefit of the doubt. And we were talking really about leadership and what good leadership should look like. And, you know, that leadership is hard. And I think there was a consensus across the board that yes, leadership is hard. We know that going into leadership when we accept leadership roles. And if we feel like we cannot do the job at hand, especially when faced with a crisis, that we should either step down or know that we have limitations and not be in those leadership roles to begin with, and give that to someone who can actually lead boldly. And the request, and this was from Dr. Pam Palmiter, to lead with human life and human health at the center of all decision-making. Mm.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Always informative to have you on, so thank you for coming back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, that about wraps it up for us this week. You can find all of our past shows and helpful links on SoundCloud.com. To ensure you don't miss an episode, please subscribe to the Beyond the Bulletin podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and recommend us to your colleagues and Waterloo alumni.
Remember to do your part to limit the spread of COVID-19 in our community. You can get in touch with us via email at bulletin@uwaterloo.ca.
As always, thanks for listening as we went Beyond the Bulletin.
I have something to show you. Hold on.
Okay. Visual aids. I like this.
Look what I bought.
Oh.
It's a doormat with a Canada doormat goose on it.
That's amazing, Pamela.
It looks in attack mode.